rolling. Let's see. Maybe. I guess we are starting maybe a few minutes earlier, but that's okay. So yesterday, during the last 15 minutes of the lecture, we moved very quickly so that you could work on the tutorial problems that you had yesterday. So that was very good, because then I hope you had time to go through the most of the tutorial. But today, we will go back to those points and do them more carefully. Something else that I should say is that yesterday, from the beginning, we followed a very non-canonical approach. Well, it's not that non-canonical, but remember that I decided to start with GR and quantum field theory, and then we went down in dimensions to one dimensions and then two dimensions, and then we discovered the the Nambu-Goto action, starting from the other action, right? But that's not the way everybody would tell you the story. So the way people would start the story is by saying, well, suppose that you want to describe a string. Okay. And the string is going to be described by a wall sheet, okay, which is parameterized by sigma and tau, and it's mapped to space-time. I'm just telling you the standard story so that if you tell somebody else, they will know that you were taught in the standard way, not the other way. So there are two ways this can be mapped into space-time. We can map the boundaries, each of the boundaries, into different lines in space-time. And what do we get? We get an open string. If we now map each of the boundaries of this domain to the same line, what we get is a closed string. And then people will tell you, just as for the point particle, as you know very well, you can write down an action, which is the world line action, which is nothing but the integral over the proper length along the action, along the world line. You can also do the same thing with the string, and then write down an action, which is nothing but the area of the string as it moves through space-time, right? And we said that there was a P that was there to match the dimensions, and G was the induced metric, right? And then the story will proceed by telling you, oh, this is great, but then it's too hard to quantize, it's too hard to study, and then we have to do a trick. We have to make a trick. And then the trick is to rewrite this action, which is the Nambu-Goto action, as a Polyakov action. So this action is a functional of x, and this action will be a functional of h and x, which you now know what it is. Okay. With our t here, and if we want to get all the factors right, we have a 1/2. And then, of course, the story will proceed by telling you that H is not a dynamical field, so we can integrate it out and go back to the Nambu-Goto action. We precisely did it the other way around, but that's okay. Now, if you start with the Nambu-Goto action, just like you did yesterday for the point particle, when you go to the non-relativistic limit, you find that this funny cosmological constant was related to the mass of the particle in the non-relativistic limit, you will find that the tension, this T, turns out to be related to the tension in the sense that is the mass per unit length. If you go to the non-relativistic limit, you can see that that's going to be the meaning of the T that is in front. Okay? Very good. So yesterday, we also said that even this action written like this with a general metric in the wall sheet metric is a little bit hard to deal with. But we know it's diffeomorphism invariant. In other words, it's reparametrization invariant. Therefore, we could use the two functions that are these degrees of freedom, the two rescalings we can make, sorry, the two changes of variables that we can make to fix two of the components of the metric to something that we like. And we also said that the metric had only three independent degrees of freedom because it was a symmetric tensor, right? And we also said that in two dimensions, and only in two dimensions, this action has a very interesting property, which is that it's also invariant under Weyl transformations. And that bought us one more function and let us fix the metric to be the Minkowski metric on the wall sheet. And I also told you that the reason why we write this like this, or people write a dot here, is that you, if your string is propagated in flat spacetime, you don't want to have two errors floating around. But we have to remember to look at the indices. We can write this error with alpha beta. And remember that this alpha and beta correspond to the wall sheet indices. And if we have error with mu nu, that would correspond to the space-time metric. OK. But this still wasn't very satisfactory, because we want to find the equations of motion and solve the equations of motion. And in these coordinates, the equations of motion look nice, but they are still not that easy to solve. So we decided to move on. Motivated by the way the wave equation looks like, we introduce Lycon coordinates on the wall sheet. Okay? We introduce what are called sigma plus and minus. By the way, if you have any questions, please stop me. So we are reviewing what we did yesterday, OK? So we introduced these coordinates, and we said, well, that's good. If we do that, then the wave equation, the equation of motion, was very simple, ended up being something like this, which looks very easy to solve. Also, something else happens, right? The metric tensor in the new coordinates looks different. Did you work out yesterday what the metric tensor looks like now in these coordinates? You did? Excellent. So in these coordinates, looks something like this. Okay? So I guess you also work out, hopefully, what the non-zero components of the energy momentum tensor, of the stress energy moment, of the stress energy tensor. Sorry. Look like in these coordinates. Did you get to do that? Okay, very good. So hopefully you were able to show that it was given by this, which we also denote as with the square meaning the contraction of the indices in space-time. Very good. Now remember that the price we pay for gauge fixing like this, in order to ensure that the gauge fixing is consistent and remains at all times, we have to impose the equations of motion of the metric, and that precisely where the vanishing of the stress energy tensor. So setting these to zero are the constraints we have to impose. Okay? Very good. So that's what we did. And then we went on to finding the solutions. Okay? So we wanted to find solutions to this equation. Then we said, well, it looks very easy. Whatever it is, it must decompose as a function that only depends on one of the coordinates and another function that only depends on the other coordinate. And that would trivially satisfy the equations of motion. And these were given names. This was the right moving, and these were the left moving degrees of freedom. Now, how do we find the solutions? Well, in order to find the solutions, we have to remember the constraints. We have to remember at some point that we have to impose this. We also have to impose that the field itself is real. Okay? Remember, yesterday we were making the analogy with the Higgs field. Is there any difference between this field and the Higgs field in the standard model? Is the Higgs field a real field? No, it's a complex scalar, right? In this case, we want our spacetime to be a real spacetime, and therefore we have to impose that these scalar fields in the worldsheet are real scalar fields. Okay? Okay, so in order to find the solutions, we said simply that if you consider the derivative with respect to sigma minus of this, only this piece will survive, right? And for this to satisfy the equations of motion, all it has to do is to be a function of sigma minus. Now, we know that in sigma, the world sheet is finite, right? It goes from 0 to pi. Therefore, we can perform a Fourier mode expansion of this function. It's a function of sigma. And sigma is a finite interval. Therefore, we can expand it in Fourier modes. Okay? Now, the fact that tau and sigma are correlated, because they can only come in this combination, means that we can also expand this in Fourier modes in this new variable, sigma minus. Okay? So we will just do it as you would do with any function that is defined on an interval. You can expand it in Fourier modes. Okay? Now, whatever the coefficients are of the expansion, let's call them alpha. They will have to have an index mu, right? Because we should have a set of alphas for each mu. These are different fields. They depend on m. We usually like these alphas to be dimensionless, yes?
You said that we can expand it Fourier mode because sigma is a finite interval.
Yes.
But sigma plus and sigma minus are not.
Right. But tau. So you could say, well, let me just take this function as a function of sigma and tau. Right? Now think of this as a function of sigma and tau independently.
Okay.
As a function of sigma, you know you can expand it as a Fourier mode. But now tau is supposed to be log to sigma in this combination. Right? That's the magic of these equations. well, not of this equation, but of this equation. The fact that this thing has to be annihilated by del plus means that the tau dependence will have to be locked to the sigma dependence just in that combination. Okay? Now, we usually like these modes to be dimensionless. What's the dimension of this? The mass dimension of this. Well, the worksheet coordinates are dimensionless. So the only dimensions is coming from the x, from the field x. So we have to put a dimension of length here, and it's called ls. It's called the string length. But it's something we put in here just in order to define these alphas to be dimensionless. Yes?
I'm slightly confused. If we have the equation del plus x squared equals 0 going from
del plus
x squared?
Yes, here.
It gives constraints, additional constraints in the alpha?
Yes, excellent. Yes, we haven't written them. So at the moment, we're not doing that. We're going step by step. We're solving first. This is the most general solution to the wave equation. And probably, let's see. All right. That's fine, yes. Because the convention is now that for the plus guys, for the left movers, we also have the same expansion, of course, because there is no difference, really. But now the Fourier modes are traditionally denoted as alpha tildes. Okay. Now, I would like to impose this condition right away. How do I ensure that my solutions are real? Well, remember, in a Fourier decomposition, these alphas are in general, they are complex numbers, right? So what do I have to do? I simply have to say and the same for tildes. Okay? Now I have imposed all these conditions. Well, really what I want to do is to find x, not only the derivative of x, but I want to find x itself. So let's find what x has to be for the right and the left movers. What we have to do is to integrate the corresponding equation. So yesterday we said that we call the constant piece. So this is constant, meaning that it doesn't depend on sigma and tau. Remember, this is a function of sigma and tau. Plus, so the suggestion yesterday was to write this on this side and alpha mu 0 on this side. Okay, so this is a 0 component in that sum. The rest can be written in the sum. And the same thing for the left movers. Okay, pretty good. Now, remember that we want to impose boundary conditions, right? This equation doesn't make sense by itself unless you give boundary conditions. And yesterday, we discussed two different kinds of boundary conditions. Actually, we discussed three. But during this week, we are only going to be using two. We said we could have closed strings if we impose periodic boundary conditions. We can have open streams. We can define, we can impose at the derivative at 0 or pi vanishes, and these were Neumann boundary conditions. Thank you very much. Yes, yes, excellent. Yeah. Or we could have Dirichlet. Okay. But we're not going to be talking about Dirichlet in this week. You will do that next week. Okay. Now, do you think that this, well, the conditions are on the whole field, X, not just on the left and the right movers. So X, remember, is the sum of the two. So let's just compute the sum. We get X mu plus, when we sum these two, what happens? We get LS tau just get this. Now, does this satisfy the closed boundary conditions? It almost does, right? These pieces are periodic, right? Under sigma going to sigma plus pi. This is a constant. This doesn't even depend on sigma. But how about this? That looks terrible. What do we do then? We can set the alphas to 0, but there is a more generic solution, which is just to set them equal to each other. Right. So let's do that. I'll just do it. So we set them equal to each other. So this is not here anymore. And this gets a 2. Now you remember why the space was there, OK? Very good. So that will do it. Now, that would be for the closed string. Now, for the open string, what we want is something whose derivative with respect to sigma will vanish at 0 and pi. So can we make any combination out of these guys that will produce a function that vanishes when you take its derivative with respect to sigma at 0 and pi? What do we have to do to the alphas and the alpha tildes in order to produce such a function? So we need a function whose derivative vanishes at 0 and pi and is made out of these functions here. How can we do it? Excellent. If we take the, if we lock the alpha tilde to be the same as alpha, we will get a cosine, and then the cosine will precisely do what we want. So let's just write it here. So for the open string, so this is for the closed string, as I wrote there. So for the open string, we will have okay, very good. Now, how can we find the meaning of this piece here? This looks certainly like the center of mass position of the string in space-time, because these are oscillators, right? So these things will oscillate. This looks certainly what would be the center of mass position. But this wants to be something like related to the momentum of the string, right? Because it has a tau dependence. So let's try to find out the physical meaning of that quantity there. Remember, we had a global symmetry, right? Well, we had many global symmetries, but there was one that was very particular to the action we wrote, because these fields, x, appear in the action only with derivatives. Do you remember? What's the global symmetry that we had? Only because we didn't have a potential term for the x's. We only had a kinetic term for the x's. Excellent, yes. So we had translation. If you think about this in field theory, when you have a field phi, this is a weird symmetry. We don't usually talk about it, because we always write a potential for it. But here, we don't have a potential, and therefore, the action was invariant under a translation, okay? Which was great, because that's what we want. We want in Minkowski space to have Poincaré invariance. So this is something we needed. Now, from the point of view of the wall sheet, this is just a global symmetry. Therefore, there will be conserved current. So what's the conserved current of this? Well, I'll leave it as an exercise to use the Noether procedure for you guys to compute the current. But it's not very hard to imagine that the current associated to a translation would be sorry. Something like this. Remember, it has an index alpha. This is a current on the wall sheet, right? It's supposed to be a vector in the wall sheet. This index is a vector index in space-time, but this is the wall sheet index. So this is the current. So what do we do to compute the conserved charge if you're given the current? What do? You pick up which component of the current?
Zero.
Yes, the zero component, right? And then what do you do with the zero component of that? And what is our space? It's just 0 to pi. Yep. And that would be our conserved charge. So let's compute that here. All this will go away, right? Because of the integration from 0 to pi. All this will go away. This doesn't contribute because we are taking a derivative with respect to tau. And we're just going to get a contribution from here. What is it? Is 2 pi ls, okay? Now, this thing can only mean one thing, right? I mean, it's in a space-time, this better be the momentum of the string. And people like to denote it as little p. Because in the quantum theory, you can think about this as the operator, if you wish, as an operator. And little p will become its eigenvalue. So you can classify states, and you can define the state with a given momentum, meaning that it will have eigenvalue little p mu. For the moment, there isn't really much of a difference. But in the quantum theory, this would mean the eigenvalue. OK. Now, it turns out that a nice definition for this ls is the following. We define it to be this. And using this definition, we find that our alpha zero oscillator, or our alpha zero modus function, turns out to be, if we plug this in here, but let me do it in more detail. Okay, and this is the definition for the closed string. It turns out that for the open string, when you do the computation, you find out that alpha mu is L string times the momentum. It doesn't have the factor of half. So let me write it here. For the closed string, we have okay. Very good. So now we go back. So somebody was asking, what happens to the constraints? We haven't solved the constraints, right? So let's see. Let's go back to the constraints. So what were the constraints? So we said T++ had to vanish, but only the left movers were contributing to it. And here only the right movers were contributing to it. And the constraint is that this has to vanish. Okay. Once again, this is a function that admits a Fourier decomposition. Okay? That was part of the tutorial yesterday. Did you get to do it? Okay, excellent. Let's see, everybody was able to compute the, okay. So maybe I should refine the question. So one thing was to show that these components were these. And the other question was to show, was to compute the Fourier mode decomposition or the Fourier mode function of this. In other words, let's see, let's do it for this one. We wanted to show that, or I wanted you guys to compute what the Fourier expansion modes were. Okay. So this is just the Fourier decomposition of this, right? Now one has to use the definition of x right of the right movers, take the derivative, and then compute this, right? So what's the way to do it? You guys will do it. If you haven't done it, you can just do it. By definition, if you want to extract the mth mode of a Fourier decomposition, all you do is just to integrate over the whole space . Now, everything that we're going to do from now on this blackboard is going to be at tau equal to zero. I'll tell you why it's fine to do it at tau equal to zero. So we will do it at tau equal to zero and integrate t minus minus. Now this thing, remember that this t minus minus from the definition of x right ends up being something of the form times. Now this q is not the dimension of a space-time, as I brilliantly tried to explain yesterday, that I couldn't come up with a better notation for the dimension of the space-time, of the worldsheet space-time. Here we're contracting with a space-time metric, right? Now, which are the terms that will survive this integral? Once I pass this integral inside the sums, right, I'll get an integral that has 2i m minus n minus q times sigma. I'll get so when do I get a non-zero answer? You see what I'm doing, right? I'm passing the integral through the sums and picking only the exponentials. So I'll get this thing inside the sums. In other words, the sums will be outside. Okay, with everything. Let me just use the dot notation here. So what is this? Excellent, yes. So this thing is nothing but a delta, Kronecker delta. So this delta this Kronecker delta will allow us to perform one of the sums, okay? So we can choose it to be whichever. I had N and Q. This was supposed to be Q. Okay? So we can perform the Q sum, and the only terms that will contribute are when Q is M minus N, and therefore, with the definition that we have here, remember, I want this guy to be dimensionless again. So that means that I forgot a square here. Because if I want this to be dimensionless, I need a square. Ends up being a single sum, which is the one that survived, of and if you work it out precisely with all the factors, you find that this is the right answer. Okay. So the same thing happens for the other ones here. We call those Fourier modes L tilde, and they are just given by the same formula, now replacing the alphas by the alpha tildes. Okay. Now, as a quantum field theory in the world sheet, what is the Hamiltonian? So how do you compute the Hamiltonian in a quantum field theory? What component of the stress energy tensor you take? The zero, zero component. Very good. And what do you do with that? Well, you do the same thing we did to find the other conserved charge, right? You integrate it over a space. So remember that the T00 component was given by this quantity. That's something we discussed yesterday, right? So in order to find the Hamiltonian, all you have to do is to integrate from 0 to pi d sigma this quantity, which is not very surprising. This is the kinetic energy, and this is the potential energy. Of course, there is a factor in front, which turns out to be t half. Now, this is an exercise for you guys to show that this quantity, once you use the formula for x, turns out to be simply related to these Fourier modes, and is nothing but 2 times L0 plus L0 tilde for the closed string, and it's just L0 for the open string. Okay. Very good. So do you remember in the case of the point particle yesterday, we found that the constraint or the equation of motion of the metric gave us the mass shell condition equation, right? Do you remember it gave us p squared plus m squared equal to 0 in the gauge where e was equal to 1? Well, hopefully we're going to get something similar here. What do you think we have to use? We now have an infinite number of constraints, right? We have to impose that all these LMs are 0. But one of them will be special. And that will give us the mass constraint for the string. What would that be? So we need an L, right, that contains the momentum of the string, right, in space-time. Because the mass is going to be the momentum squared. So we need an L that contains, in its expansion, it contains alpha 0 squared. That would be the trick to find the mass for the string, right? So we know that alpha 0, mu, is proportional to the momentum of the string. And what we want is something that tells us about the mass of the string. Right? So which Fourier mode contains alpha 0 squared? Well, we just look here. Which one? So we need m to be 0 in order to have a chance of getting alpha 0 with alpha 0. Right? Only for m equal to 0, we're going to get alpha 0 contracted with itself. Now, the constraint, remember, is that alpha 0, that L0 must be 0, and L tilde 0 must be 0. This is for the closed string. In the case of the open string, we only have one set of Fourier modes. Remember, we had to set the alphas and the alpha tildes to be equal in the open string case. So in the closed string, we have two copies of this. In the closed string case, we have two copies of the set of Fourier modes. And in the open string, we only have one. Now, when we impose this condition, all we have to do is to take this and separate the zero component. And what do we get? So let's write down L0 explicitly, and we will separate the zero component. OK. Now you see, this has a symmetry, right? Under n going to minus n. So we can remove this half. If we go now from 0 to infinity, using what we found here, the relation between alpha 0 and the momentum, we can work out what this is. And it turns out to be excellent. Thank you. Yes. From 1. Yes. Thanks. OK. So if we use this definition, remember here we find the mass. And this must be 0. Therefore, we can find what the mass is of the string. Now, in the closed string, we have the two sets of oscillators. OK? Therefore, we would like to write a formula that is symmetric with respect to the two of them. So the formula that we want to write is something that looks like that treats both oscillators in a symmetric way. Okay, so that would be the mass formula for the closed string. And for the open string, remember that the definition is slightly different. There are factors of two difference. Okay, so for the open string, we will find okay. Before we do that, let me say that, remember, from the connection we wanted between the oscillator, between the mass of the strings and the formula that you got from the Veneziano amplitude to describe a relativistic string. Remember that the whole thing started because we wanted to describe this bunch of hadrons that were appearing in the experiments, right? And their mass was related to the spin, and we had this proportionality constant alpha prime entering in the story. It turns out that in order to match that historically, when you work out these formulas, what you have to do in order to get the correct relation between the mass square and the spin, you have to define the slope to be, or the string length, to be related to the slope by this formula. Okay? So this alpha prime ended up sticking in the whole story. But remember, the origin of alpha prime was when we tried to interpret this infinite number of hadrons, or this large number of hadrons that people were seeing, where their mass was related to their spin. And the proportionality constant was alpha prime, was called alpha prime. So when you do that, this factor becomes 1 over alpha prime. Actually, it becomes 2 over alpha prime. And for the open string, it becomes just 1 over alpha prime. And we only have one set of oscillators. Okay. All right, very good. So everything we have been doing up to now is classical field theory, nothing quantum. And I told you that all the fun starts when we quantize this theory. In particular, I told you that the massless particles that are interesting for us, the graviton and the gauge fields, will come from where? Will come because there will be a quantum effect. Do you remember which quantum effect we talked about two days ago? We said that there will be a Casimir effect that will shift the spectrum, and that will end up giving us interesting massless particles which have non-zero helicity in four dimensions. So did you guys get to work out through, I mean, in the tutorial the first day, you were supposed to work out the difference between the little group of the massive particles and massless particles in D dimensions. Did you go through that? Okay. If you haven't, you should do that today, okay? So today there is no tutorial. So, but that's something that you should try to do today. Okay, because we are going to use that tomorrow very much. And then I'll pick random people to come out and work out the representation theory and the, I'm kidding, but. Maybe we can do it, right? So if you're given a bunch of tensors that transform under SO24, right? And I tell you, would all these guys combine into something that transforms nicely under SO26? So you should be able to tell me right away that yes or no. Under SO25, sorry. Yes, you see, you should have told me it was SO25. No, but seriously, try to go through that exercise of the first day, okay? That was the last one, I think. Yeah. Okay, so very good. So, and also try today to finish the, if you haven't, to finish the tutorial, the exercises that were there for yesterday, right? Okay, so the last part of the Virasoro algebra, which I'm going to tell you about in a second, or yesterday we tried to define what it was, but let's do this first. So in quantum field theory, if you want to quantize your quantum fields, you can do a path integral quantization, which I'm I'm assuming you're all experts with path integrals. That's why we're not going to do path integrals. We're going to do something else. We're going to do the canonical quantization. So what do you do when you want to do the canonical quantization? You take your fields, right? In our case, we have our fields x mu, and you have to find their canonical conjugate, right? This thing ended up being, if you remember before, the z dot component of the conserved current. Here, we're going to drop the zero here and just call it P. Okay? We will just think about this P as being the canonical conjugate variable to X mu. Okay? Now, in classical field theory or in classical mechanics, we have Poisson brackets, right? So what is a Poisson bracket? First of all, in quantum field theory, you define Poisson brackets. So you have two options, at the same position and different times, or at the same time and different positions. What do you think? Same time, yes. Very good. Equal time tau. And what is that supposed to be? Very good, yes. And what is this supposed to be? Excellent, yes. It vanishes unless the sigmas are the same. Since sigma is a continuous variable, we need a Dirac delta function. Very good. So once we're given these Poisson brackets, well, it's not that we're given these Poisson brackets. We just compute the Poisson brackets. We know what they are. We can now use the modus function in order to derive the Poisson brackets of the Fourier modes using the definition of P as a derivative in time in the tau of the x. Okay? So that's also an exercise for you guys to show that by using this and this and the explicit formulas, you find the following Poisson brackets. And this is going to be important because these Poisson brackets are precisely what are going to get us into trouble when we discuss the quantization. Because there is something funny going on with the metric, right? So one of the components will have a minus sign. So at the classical level, there is nothing fancy going on. This is just what they are. There is no problem. But we will see that at the quantum level, the fact that the 0,0 component has a minus sign will lead to something that will break unitarity. And it will lead to particles that people call ghosts that break unitarity. They have negative norm square. Okay. So at some point, we talk about tachyons, which have a negative mass square. That's not as bad as having negative norm square. As I told you, we think the Higgs starts its life as a tachyon. So that's not a problem. But but having lack of unitarity, that's really a problem. Okay. Now, the last part of the exercise of yesterday's tutorial was to show that by using these Poisson brackets, okay, for the oscillator modes, you could also compute the Poisson brackets of these Fourier modes, and it ended up being something like this. Now, when you see quantities whose Poisson bracket gives you back the same quantity, you say that these quantities form an algebra. Okay? And this algebra has a name. It's called the Virasoro algebra. Since these guys are the constraints for our theory, we could also say that these guys are the algebra of constraints of our theory. Now, these L and M's, these LMs, end up being conserved charges of our theory. Remember that the energy momentum tensor was a conserved current, and these LMs end up being conserved charges. So how come that we have conserved charges? And not only that, we have an infinite number of conserved charges. If we have that, we were supposed to have a symmetry in the wall sheet that gave rise to these conserved charges. What could that symmetry be? Remember that we gauge fixed the diffeomorphisms and the Weyl symmetry and the Weyl invariants. So we fixed those local invariances. So how come that we now, all of a sudden, find an infinite number of conserved charges? Well, as we will see, the gauge fixing we use to set the metric to be the Minkowski metric didn't gauge fix everything completely. And it left over a piece of diffeomorphisms that wasn't fixed. Okay, what piece could it be? Well, if you think about it, if you make a diffeomorphism that basically rescales the metric, you can now undo that with a Weyl transformation. So those two will give you something that can still be a symmetry of the Lagrangian after we set the metric to be the Minkowski metric. So those symmetries are still there in the Lagrangian, and they end up being or generating what is called the conformal group. Now you would say this is completely silly because we know very well, right, that the conformal group, what are the generators of the conformal group? It contains the Poincaré group and what else? Do you remember? Have you ever seen the conformal group? Okay. So the conformal group has dilations, right? So rescalings in space, in coordinate space, you can rescale the coordinates. You can also perform what are called special conformal transformations, okay? But basically means that you can take the points and invert the points, okay? Well, the point what I want to make is that when we discuss a conformal group, everybody tells you that the conformal group has only a finite number of generators. And here we found an infinite number of generators. Now, it turns out that the conformal group has an infinite number of generators. Only in two dimensions. So the fact that this group becomes infinite dimensional is the thing that will allow us to do all these crazy things we talked about the first day, of sending this wall sheet that looked like something that was coming in, splitting, and joining again into a disk, and then the disk into different looking objects. And the different regimes that we had, which were dangerous in the integration region to define the quantum theory, we could map them to just very safe infrared physics. Okay? So this is going to be the magic of the story. Okay. Very good. Now, most probably, you can tell me what we can do now to go to the quantum theory, right? So we will continue with that tomorrow. But let's set up what the story is going to be. Because I think we have, what do we have, like, really? Wow, we're doing well. Yes, because this is actually my regular hour, right? So this is, well, slightly 5 minutes, yes. OK. In some frame. Well, I'll just do like we did yesterday. I'll just tell you very quickly what we're going to do tomorrow. Okay, so tomorrow you don't hear the words and just panic. This will be familiar things to you by tomorrow, hopefully. Okay. So in the quantization, what do? We take our Poisson brackets, we take our fields, and we think about them not as functions, but as operators. Okay, and the Poisson brackets are now going to be commutators of the operators. So we take our Poisson brackets and send them into commutators with an I. Well, easier said than done, because we're going to run into trouble, as I said. The reason is the following. We're going to be dealing with the commutators of these operators. Remember, when you quantize the harmonic oscillator, you also get something very similar to this. So these guys are going to play the role of the creation and the annihilation operators, because it just looks like an infinite number of harmonic oscillators. So let me normalize the creation and annihilation operators nicely. This will be the annihilation operators. Now remember the condition that the field X was real ended up being a condition between alpha M and alpha minus M, right? If these are operators, before these were just complex numbers. Now if these are operators, what do I have to do? I have to replace this by what? Excellent. So quantizing is very easy, right? So you just replace the Poisson brackets by commutators, stars by daggers, and we're done. Well, Rob Specking will kill me if I say that, right? Well, the procedure is easy. Probably the difficult thing is interpretation of what you're doing. So let's define these to be our operators. Okay, so this would be the annihilation operators, this would be the creation operators. So how do you define your Hilbert space? The first thing you have to do is to define a vacuum for the Hilbert space. How do you define the vacuum? Well, the vacuum is going to be a state that is normalized. And what's the condition we impose on that object? Excellent, yes. We impose that it's annihilated by all the annihilation operators. OK? That's the definition of our vacuum. Now, a general state is constructed out of the vacuum by applying creation operators. So we can apply n of them, and we get a general state. Now remember the commutation relation we got for the zeroth component. When we had the metric, we got a minus sign. Therefore, we can try to consider the following state. let me call it G. And we would like to compute the norm of this state. I'll leave it as an exercise for today to show that the norm of G is equal to minus 1. So this G just stands for our ghost. Now, do you know any other theory that has ghosts? Have you ever encountered another theory? Yes, which one? Yes, even electromagnetism, right? Very good. Yes. Excellent. Yes. Well, the same thing is going to happen here, depending on what we do, right? So tomorrow we're going to follow a shortcut. We're not going to do covariant quantization. We're going to do Lycon quantization, right? But if you take even in four dimensions any gauge theory and you do a covariant quantization, then you will also find gauss, right? And there you have symmetries in order to restrict your Hilbert space and kill those gauss, right? Now, how many gauss particles do we have here? Yes. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Otherwise it's zero. Then we'll be fine. Now, how many of these guys do we get? Well, first of all, we have m here. So we have lots of them. We have an infinite number. But in fact, any state that contains an odd number of zeros in it will have negative norm. So we have an infinite number of these guys. If you have an infinite number of these guys, it sounds almost hopeless to be able to impose constraints that will kill, that will project them out of the Hilbert space, of the physical Hilbert space. But guess what? We found that in the quantum, yes, sorry.
If your alpha m's are equal to the alpha minus m daggers, doesn't that make every single creation operator an annihilation operator as well?
No, sorry. Very good.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's what we said here. Very good. So this is a quantum patch in this classical world. Okay, so don't confuse this with whatever we had before. Yeah. So the point now is that how many constraints we have to impose on our Hilbert space? We have to impose that all these L operators, these Virasoro generators will now become operators, and all these operators must annihilate the Hilbert space. Okay? And the fact that we are in two dimensions gave us an infinite number of those, and it turns out that that infinite number of guys will allow us, only for certain special values of the space-time dimension, will allow us to kill, to project out all these ghosts from the spectrum. So we will produce a theory that is ghost-free using the infinite number of constraints that we had coming from the conformal symmetry or these Virasoro generators, only when the space-time dimension, in this case, is 26. And that's what we will see tomorrow. But we will do it using a shortcut. We will do Lycon quantization tomorrow. OK? Any questions? So that's why I need you guys to review the little group story for massive and massless particles, especially for massless particles. At least try to understand the exercise for the massless particles. Okay?